Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
There is a place where time stands still, where nature is harsh and demanding, where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man.
I want my land.
Took it in the guts, Barry. Far away from my...
All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test. Three simple questions, three correct answers,
you get all this
and
together?
You go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
Good morning, everybody, or everybody in digital land, because this week, of course, the transistors and the radios aren't blaring because somebody in the powers that be are dealing with something unspecified, probably in some memo somewhere, looking after the AM band in the radio world. So we're all in digital land today, and I'm going to highlight two films that are on at the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. It's coming to the end. It's will be finishing on the 31st. These two films are fabulous. They're both going to be on Sunday the 27th of July at 3:25 is the Nicholas Building. This is Mark Newbold's film. I'll let you listen to the conversation that we had. It becomes apparent what he's doing is investigating the creativity and craftsmanship or craftspersonship that is displayed by the people who live and work at the Nicholas Building in the city. It features Anna Vanadoff, William Llewellyn Griffiths, Nicholas Jones, Darren McDonald, Louise McDonald, Jason Patterson, Paul Zicker, Stephen McLaughlin, Marcus Guzman, Brendan Dwyer, Mary Burgess, and Vicky Cassioras. So it's an interesting film, and it's interestingly made. And I think that Mark is a very interesting filmmaker. So that's the first of the films. The second is The New Peasants, but I'll tell you a bit about that when we get to it. So here we go, my chat with Mark Newbold.
So for quite a while I've been making short films about artists in their studios, really just observational documentaries. So not interviews, just filming people making things, usually making an object from start to finish, and sort of just distributing them mostly online so people were watching them that way. So I really wanted to make a feature film, and I thought I'll combine those that filmmaking I'm doing, this observational style, with interviews, and then I'd have a kind of consistent feature-length film.
Okay, and one of the things that's most compelling about your films is the attention to detail, the ability to shoot very close up so we as the audience can actually understand what the person's doing, as well as exquisite a level of attention to the sounds. So can you tell me how you used that to orchestrate a feature? Because it's a long time, it's an hour and a half, and what you've done is create almost like a dialogue-less interior. That's what you've done, in a way.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so there's a few things to that. So the one thing, these films with a person making a thing, I didn't think that could be sustained for an hour and a half film by itself, which is why I did the interviews. So about half of the film is interviews and half of the films are the observational parts.
But they're about the same thing.
Yeah, that's it. They're about the same thing. So that's the thing. Like, because I've been making these short films about the people making things for such a long time without interviews, there's always a dimension to the art-making process that I couldn't capture by observation. I mean, you can get a lot through observation, seeing what they do and how they do it. But the other elements to the artistic life, you've got to talk to people. And so that seemed like a natural complement to the observational stuff.
So do you see your filmmaking as an art artistic pursuit in the same way as the people that you are filming.
Yes, I do. That's right. And so the questions that I asked all of the participants were, I always thought, well, what shall I ask them when I sit down for an interview? And I thought, well, what would I want someone to ask me? And so I wrote down about 10 questions that I would want someone to ask me about my artistic practice. And that kind of worked, I think.
Oh, wow. Let's hope I ask you some of them.
Yeah, okay, go.
You said that you started making films about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Did you stumble upon it, or what happened?
Okay. So I work as a teacher in environmental studies at university. There was kind of a thing where I always liked cinema, and I made a lot of home videos with my kids and stuff like that. And so I thought,
you had opinions.
Yeah, opinions. I had opinions about environmental issues, you know.
More particularly, when you took those family shots and all the rest of it, you must have started to understand length of time of shot as well as drama intrinsic to the frame.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I really enjoyed doing that. So this was just home videos, but I did edit them correctly, you know, or nicely. And I got better at it as I went along. So I thought, you know, it'd be really nice to learn how to make films properly and do that in, for environmental education. That was my plan. So I went to VCA and did a master's, and I learnt the tools of the trade there, how to use a proper camera and how to edit things using, more sophisticated software, and how to record sound better and production quality, all the rest of it. So, and that was a great experience. I learnt more formally that way. And that's when I started to make more films that weren't home videos.
Mm, just as a matter of interest, from what you'd learned at the beginning by yourself and then harnessed it in a more professional way, was there compatibility, or did you chuck things out?
Actually, no, that's funny, because the first few things I made when I was at film school was like, this isn't as good as what I was doing at home. And I think maybe I kind of got a little bit confused about where I was at with what I wanted to do with it. I kind of got the hang of it eventually.
Yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's all about, I was talking to someone else who said he makes things by himself with a camera, with sound. He has worked in bigger groups and he does like that, but he doesn't like it when everybody's really interested in their titles rather than the making of the film.
One thing that I gravitated towards as a working process at film school and then kept going afterwards, which is to do everything by myself. I mean, at film school, they're encouraged to have crews, and so everybody would have a crew, and you'd crew on each other's films. And so, someone would be the sound person with the boom, and someone's doing the camera, and someone's the director, and somebody else might doing lighting or whatever.
Because you've got to be able to communicate with each other. That's what they think. You've got to be able to get money to make your films.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's why you've got to be able to communicate, got to get other people to do things for you.
Yeah, right, yeah. But
that's not your purpose.
Well, that's the thing. I like just doing it all myself, and that way I can, A, control everything myself and do it the way I want to do it, and B, I don't have to worry about budgets or funding, because all I got to do is pay myself and I'm free.
Yeah. And also you've got another way of making a living. Did you know the people who were in the Nicholas building?
I knew some people. So I got a grant from the City of Melbourne to do a series of shorts.
So you're not completely incapable of getting your own funding?
No, just a little, City of Melbourne arts grant. It's pretty, they were good. I sort of knew people at Craft Victoria who were, I'd filmed people that they represent.
Yes.
And so I had a contact there and I said, let's put in a grant proposal together to do a series of shorts of people who were represented by Craft Victoria.
Yep.
And that's how I met some people from this Nicholas building.
Yeah, which is a great place, because it frames the whole discussion that you're doing in terms of artistic endeavour.
Yeah, that's it. So the building itself, there's a lot of people there. There's a lot of studios, and there's a lot of interesting people there. So it was a good device for a feature to be able to sort of say, okay, that'll kind of give it some kind of unity to be able to say, okay, we'll call it the Nicholas Building, and there's all these people working in this particular space.
It's a bit like Alice in Wonderland, really, in a way, isn't it? Because you're going into people's places. Now, tell me, what were the challenges?
the challenges were just finding the time to do it all, I guess, you know? I mean, because, okay, I wasn't funded, so I'm chipping away at my own time mostly. So I was partly funded. I got another City of Melbourne grant to do the shorts of the making things.
Ah, right.
Yeah, yeah. So that was...
So it's a developmental... First it started off as the shorts, as you said at the beginning, and now it's developed into an hour and a half long feature, which has got many more leaks, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah. So the funding was for the shorts, and I made the shorts, and then I was like, okay, now I'm going to make the feature out of this. And so that was doing all the interviews. Was the other half
right.
Of it.
So yeah, yeah. Did you incorporate the shorts that you'd already shot?
Yeah.
And then interleave them with the interviews?
Correct. That's
okay,
it.
Okay, all right. Yeah, so yeah. You'd already done all that hard work. It's actually quite hard. I mean, I know that artists like to do their art, but they don't always necessarily like to talk about what they're doing or why they're doing it. But you obviously are a person that they felt quite comfortable with.
I think that I developed a rapport with everybody first by making these films of them making things, because I'd already sort of spent days or, you know, a day at least in the studio with them. So they already knew me. And so when I contacted them later on and said, I want to turn into a feature and can we do an interview? Everyone was great. Everyone was like, yeah, sure. Come in and see me. Nobody said no. Mm. So, and so I guess I had the rapport and, yeah, that people felt comfortable talking to me, I think.
And so ultimately it was in the edit that it was sewn together.
Yeah, yeah. So the original shorts of people, the observational documentary part of it were much longer, so I shortened them down to, you know, sort of like 4 or 5 minutes each one. And then I did an hour-long interview with everybody and then cut those down to about 4 or 5 minutes each too. So, and then it was a matter of sort of putting those parts together, the observational parts and the interview parts.
Did you have key understandings about artistic process, or were they divulged to you in those conversations or in those actions from the people?
So I had my own ideas about artistic process from my own process. Like, I asked questions that were pretty open, and people gave answers that I was sort of surprised with. I mean, I hadn't thought about it that way. And so people said things that were like, this is how I come up with ideas, or this is how I experiment, or this is how I view the art making process. These are all different perspectives, I think. And that's the thing with making art. Everyone does it differently.
Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? And the other thing about it is you do these rather nice, tasty sort of exterior shots from the windows. Did you do them before or after?
During. So I was usually in people's studios, and I'll get some stuff from the windows. Sort of helps to situate the people in the place, you know, because you can see Flinders Street Station from
the
windows. Yeah. So it's sort of...
And also the quality of the light in the sky.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I filmed most of that in winter, like this time last year, actually. And, yeah, it was a very moody time, and it was a really, really cold week, and it was great, actually, because it kind of got the mood that I wanted to get.
That's interesting. So you had a sense of mood.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, when I was thinking about making it, I was like, oh, you know, it's a big effort to make a film. And I was sitting there, and I just kind of got a sense of a mood, and I thought, you know, I like that. You know, there's this kind of feeling. If I can get that across in a film, that's inspiring. That's what is something I would like to create. I'd like to make that.
I really liked your film. I found it a filmmaker's film. Because I do radio, the sounds in it were just so incredible and precise. I was thinking about how you shot it. So did you learn how to do that at the time, or did you already have theories about how to do it?
It's sort of just doing it on the spot. I mean, I got a bit of experience because I've been on quite a few of these ones before. Yeah, look, it's really just one thing. I always ask people to turn off the lights so that it's natural light coming through the windows, and that sets a certain tone for lighting anyway, if it's possible. And then it's just they make the thing and I just move around, and I usually don't direct them at all. You know, they're just doing it as they would normally do it.
That's what's interesting. It's so much like taking live sound and getting people to do what they're doing without interfering with them. Mm. I mean, that's what's the fascination.
Yeah, yeah. Because the thing is, I learnt from doing actually that it, whenever I interfered and said, "Oh, let's set this a bit more formally," it wouldn't work.
No,
it would feel really phony or something like that. So the more I just stayed out of the way, the better it was.
Yeah, well, see, that's what I mean. I mean, that's a very artful approach to making a film. Have you? It's in the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. Have you shown it to other people? And if so, what are their reactions?
I haven't shown it to anybody yet, so this is new. Like, I'm talking to you, you're one of the only people I know who've watched the film from start to finish. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'm honoured.
Good.
Hi, my name is Rolf De Heer. I don't live in Melbourne. I live across the water in Tasmania. But if I did live in Melbourne, my number one radio station would be 3CR because it's about community, and community matters.
And you're on Showreel with Annie, and that was a little chat with Mark Newbold about his film, The Nicholas Building. And as you can tell, it's a bit of poetry. Sunday, the 27th of July at the Nova, 3:25. And following that screening is going to be the screening of The New Peasants. And I got to speak to Jordan Osman, who is the filmmaker involved in that film. The New Peasants is now the Sunday, 27th of July, 5:35 p.m. Screening is booked out. So they're now open for an encore season on Wednesday, July the 30th at 8:40 p.m. So get your tickets if you want to see The New Peasants. And this is my chat with John Osborne. Osmond, sorry.
Thanks very much for taking some time to talk to me. The New Peasants. Tell me, how long did it take you to, did they allow you to be part of their life while you were filming this documentary?
Yeah, I was lucky to be able to live on the property for 5 months all up. Initially moving to the area, I was just living there on in a little cabin, and then the idea for this feature film came out while I was there, just participating in daily life and being a part of the family's rhythms. And we have made 3 short films with this family over the last 7 years, and so yeah, those have been very successful online, and there's just so much more to be able to explore in an hour-long film, which is what we've created here.
Yeah, that's right. And it, and for people who don't know, it's really about a family that it's a 20-year experiment, isn't it, that they're living?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's been a slow journey over 20 years of seeing the issues that we're facing in the world environmentally and socially, and these big picture problems, and then thinking, how do we as a family respond, and making those small changes to their life over those 20 years. So it's been 15 years since they've eaten food from the supermarket, and the same length of time since they've owned a car. But you know, those things didn't happen overnight. It's been a transition over time, kind of step by step. Apparently it started with giving up using bin liners on the rubbish bin. They realized, oh, we don't really need this because we can just rinse the bin. And that was the moment of like, oh, what else can we give up kind of on this journey? And now, yeah, 20 years later, this film is a portrait of what their life looks like, and the rhythms and the beauty and the challenges involved in that. I've heard them say before, saying no to some things is saying yes to others. And I think that is so true and so valuable, because they're probably the most time rich people that I know. So by saying no to by embracing living below the poverty line on something like $30,000 a year, I think, and meeting most of their needs without money, has been able to free them up to have time to do these things that, you know, a lot of us don't have time to grow as much food or process food or farm, or, you know, do all these activities that do take a lot of time. So by saying kind of no to certain things like car ownership, which can be expensive, has kind of been able to them to say yes to being at home more, and, you know, being more involved in these processes of their life.
It's also meant that they've built community. It's part of intrinsic to the economy of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. It's essential to being able to live the way they do. They say around 80% of their needs are met without money. They still need to pay rates and have a very small electricity bill, and they do buy bits and pieces of food because they only live on a quarter of an acre. So a lot of the veggies they grow themselves, and meat and things, but other foods they do buy in. So there's a small requirement for money, but then 80% of it is met through the gift economy. So gift exchanges with neighbours and the wider community for different things. They run a bush school for local kids. There's about 10 to 15 kids who come every Monday, and that's completely free, or it's done in the gift economy. So the parents might bring food or secondhand clothes or building materials, and it's kind of an exchange in a way, but it's not a transactional one-for-one. It's it's that kind of gifting with the trust that these gifts will come back in some form, maybe not so direct.
There's an interesting dynamic within the film itself. It's obviously the way the people live, how Meg, Patrick and Woody live, gives the ebb and the flow of the film. But there's other signposts as well. So one of them that I found incredibly interesting was when Patrick decided that there would be a more natural way of dealing with the copse, the wooded area, as opposed to allowing the CFA to do this intrusive burn, which is completely unnuanced. But the use of the goats, that sort of stuff, it changed the way people related to the environment, but also the management profile for the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe 100 metres from their house is this forest around Dalesford. And in a part of that forest, they are reducing the fire load using goats. So the goats eat blackberries and bring that highly flammable material down and reduce it. And this is an alternative to what they've seen the planned burns do in the past, where they can be very hot and destructive, very different to Indigenous burning, which is a cooler, slower burn. They've seen the devastation that can happen in certain situations, and they observed it in this forest. So seeing that 10 years ago prompted them to think, oh, how are we going to manage this differently so they don't have to come and burn again? And so for maybe 5 years now, they've been managing a herd of goats on common land, on Jarrah land, and it's basically operating due to social license. They don't have any council permits or anything. It's about getting all the neighbours on board, being involved and approving of that activity. They can see the benefit. They can appreciate the fact that the fire risk to their own homes is lessened because of this. And in exchange, this family gets meat from the goats. It's about them being able to farm essentially on common land because they don't have the land themselves to have a big farm. So they can, provide an ecological service and also meet some of their own needs through that as well.
But it also indicates that there is a altering of the community's understanding of the place where they live just by these people's approach to things. It's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very cool. Just it's a public demonstration of some of these values that this family lives, and even just walking past and you can walk down this road and see where the goats are, and then maybe Patrick or Woody will be there and you can have a chat about what's going on. It's that kind of seeing, oh, there's a different way of doing this. And I think that's a similar thing to many aspects of their life. They run tours occasionally of their home and garden too. And I think that's where the power is, and be able to see an alternative way of doing something. I think a lot of us can see the issues that we're facing in the world and want to do something about it. And so to be able to see small ways that we can incorporate things into our lives and make our own changes in the face of these kind of larger issues.
The film is called The New Peasants, right? It's kind of funny, isn't it?
Yeah. I really like the idea of the new peasants and that kind of connection to their own ancestry as well. Bringing it into the modern day, they're not kind of trying to replicate hundreds of years ago peasant life.
Yeah, they're not unrealistic, which is quite interesting. And the other thing that's really interesting is the heartbreak and the effect that Zephyr's experience had, where their lifestyle was considered to be so different that it had a negative effect on him within the social community that he was growing up in the mainstream.
Yeah, yeah, their eldest son, that journey is shared within the film, and it is a emotional kind of, yeah, harder story that we share. But I think it's important to show, yeah, these are real people and with real issues, and these things can happen. And it's, you know, I think it shows that challenge of doing something different in a world that kind of can see that as strange or weird, or you can come up against kind of the mainstream culture by trying to do things differently. And the challenges that Zeph has been through, that story is a part of that. Yeah, there's many factors to that we do talk about in the film, but that is one of it, of that kind of tension between trying to do something different, but you're also still attached to the real world. You're still kind of part of it too.
Yeah, and it's very generous of them to actually share that part of their journey with the viewing public, I'd have to say. They're very courageous people, aren't they, really?
They are, yeah. Yeah, I've been so inspired by them over the years. And sharing that story, I had known that story before beginning this film, but wasn't thinking it would be part of this story. But then maybe halfway through, they felt kind of called to share it. And I'm really glad they did, because this hard story informs a lot of the work they do, especially in the community, and kind of underlines a lot of that work they do. And so it's kind of in there to show, it's in there for a reason.
The other thing is, the fact that they decide they're going to go on a journey, they're going to go overseas, and they obviously got themselves a passport and all the rest of it, so they must have followed those protocols. But they put on their knapsacks and then they just go out and thumb a ride. And then we get these pictures. They actually made it and they actually did it and they had a great old time.
Yeah, when was it? Maybe 10 or 11 years ago, they did a big bike trip up to Cape York and back. Yeah, that's right. So they're very used to this kind of extreme form of travel, this radically simple travel. And so wanting to go to India, do some overseas travel, but not wanting to fly, that was the initial thought for it. And so the plan was to hitchhike and catch boats and get all the way to India. So, experience another culture. They did. Yeah, yep. They have written about the experience on their blog, and they did make it. They did have to take a couple of short flights because they just physically couldn't, you know, the bus wouldn't go there or anything. But it took them about 2 months to get to India. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic, which is, you know, the process is as important as the going. I presume that other people looked after their house or something. You know, they closed off everything and then went off. But it's just pretty amazing. Everything about these people is amazing. It's you must have had a great old time making the film, though.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was such a unique experience, because normally when we're making a film, it's a certain shoot schedule. It might be 3 days for a short film. It might be a couple of weeks, but it's, you know, an intense set amount of days, and okay, we're going to fit this in that day and that day. But here I was just living on the property, so they could come over at any point and say, hey, we're doing this. Do you want to come and film it? And I could just pick up my camera and go and really catch that organic, natural flow of the life. It was, you know, it's, didn't feel staged or set up or anything. It was very organic, and it was a lot of fun participating as well. I was helping out in the garden. Part of my rent was doing one day's work on the land a week. So I got to learn a lot of skills myself as well.
The editing must have been the key element, really.
Yeah, yeah. There was something like 65 hours of footage all up, which is a lot to get through. And yeah, we worked with an editor to help bring a fresh perspective and help us piece a lot of that together. So that was a really fun process, but it was so difficult because there's so much beautiful footage and so many avenues we could have explored further down. But it's that tricky space of reducing to make the story shine.
Yeah, which is what you do. And like I said, it's at the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. Are you showing it in other places as well?
Yeah, yep. So the world premiere is this Sunday at the Melbourne Doc Film Fest on Sunday afternoon. And then that's kind of the beginning of the screening tour that I'm doing in Australia. August 1st, it screens in Castlemaine, Ballarat on the 2nd, and I'm doing about 14 screenings up the East Coast over the next 2 months. So we've got information on our website about those.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.